Mark, for all the planning that you do all week long, the way you run the football and getting a couple of early turnovers sure makes things easy, doesn't it?
Oh, it takes a lot of pressure off the quarterback.
Now, Mark, you know that during TV timeouts, we leave our cameras on.
Yeah, I heard.
Have you always been a mustard guy on your hot dog?
Yeah, that was stupid. I didn't eat much before the game this morning. I couldn't eat. I had a terrible stomach ache, and on the sideline, I asked somebody for a hot dog, and they got one. So I tried to eat it.
It was medicinal.
I wasn't feeling very good.
But, okay.
I'm going to get in trouble for that one, I bet.
Hey, Mark, have a good trip back to New York.
Sir. Thanks, guys. Take care.
Congrats.
Happy holidays, everybody. Number 50. Holy crap. I did 49 of these already? Ugh, who thought that was going to happen? Unbelievable. Hey, listen, I'm just happy to be around after all the crap that's gone on this year. Welcome back to My Life as a Foodie. It's our year-end blowout show, and I'm excited to be talking with Greg Kane again a little later in the show. You may remember Greg from FineLobster.com, CrabPlace.com. We had him on the show back in September, and I wanted to bring him back for a special New England Christmas. It's kind of a seafood Christmas type of thing. It's a Christmas in New England. It's kind of traditional, and we'll be discussing these traditions and the big lobster feast that they have there in Christmas every year. The thing I recalled about Christmas when I was growing up is that we always had fish on Christmas Eve. And I never knew why it was until much later in life. As it turns out, you don't eat meat on Christmas Eve because you're celebrating the birth of Jesus. And I didn't know if this was a Catholic thing or what. You know, we weren't Catholic. I mean, my mother was raised Catholic, but she wasn't Catholic for long. And we weren't raised Catholic. But it's just a tradition. And I found out later that it's traditional with Italians. And we were Sicilian, but Italian. So they call it the seven fish dinner, and you're supposed to have seven types of fish to represent the 7 days that it took God to create the universe. But we usually ended up eating canned tuna, tuna casserole or something, because, you know, times are tight. And my mother couldn't cook a fish anyway. You know, I loved a woman, right? She couldn't cook fish to save her life. She put a whole fish in a pan with a little bit of butter on high heat. It burned the damn thing to death. It's already dead, Mom, but she's burning it anyway. The whole house would just be smoky and fishy and just horrible. So anyway, Father Spoon at Should I Drink That? I was talking to him about it. I remember that he was doing this Fish on Fridays thing for Good Sunday or Good Friday or something. Anyway, he's Catholic, right? Because he's father. I asked him about it. Turns out his wife grew up in an Italian household. Seven types of fishes or a white dinner. That's the tradition. And she said that the white dinner was different. You can have seven fishes, or if you chose to do the white dinner, there were only seven things on the table. You had white spaghetti, which is pasta, black olives, smelts, shrimp, clams and oysters, calamari, and blessed bread. Or you could do the seven fishes dinner, which was calamari, shrimp, oysters, smelts, herring, haddock, and something else, whatever it was. But I'll tell you what, if we had lobster, that would have made things so much better. I could totally see eating lobster seven times. I probably would realize I was in the wrong house. But, man, New England, they got it made, man. But on the subject of fish, and we've got a really serious situation here on my coast, here in California. The Department of Fish and Game is about to make fishing illegal off of certain areas of our coast because of overfishing. And they're starting to protect certain parts of the ocean because there aren't any fish there, or they're getting really low. We've been threatening this for years. I knew it was coming, and now it's happening. We're overfished. It's really sad, man. It's a sad situation, but it kind of seems to be the sign of the times. You know, this whole thing, we talked about the bluefin tuna. You know, it's getting near extinction. That's definitely an issue. Soon we won't have bluefin tuna sushi because of overfishing. I have to wonder how long this is going to continue and at what point it starts to affect our ability here on this coast to put food on the table. You know, is farm-raised fish the answer for us? It might be, you know, if we can't keep the ocean supplied. I don't know if poaching's a problem or what, but It's an issue, obviously, and the Department of Fish and Game have spoken up. But man, my state's a mess. It doesn't matter if you're in the water or on the land, it's a mess. Anyway, I've got a beer here. We're going to have a beer to send the show, get the show started right, and then send the year off. It was sent to me from Rick at Big Foamy Head, bigfoamyhead.com, part of the Beer Safari. You know, beersafari.com, it's a jungle of beer. Rick is awesome about sharing really good, rare beers with me because he lives in Colorado, near Denver. And if you don't know, Colorado is kind of like the mecca of for beer. That's why they have the Great American Beer Festival there, because it's kind of the place to be. It's quite uncommon for me to find any of these beers from Avery Brewing outside of Colorado. And by these beers, I mean these rare barrel-aged beers that they make. Avery, I can get a lot of Avery beers here, but Avery Brewing has been doing these barrel-aged beers for about a year or two. And I reviewed the last one on my blog. It was called Brabant, and I had blood sausage with it. It was really good, and you know, I'm not a big sour beer fan, but this thing was something else. This beer is called Sui Generis. Am I mispronouncing this? Probably. S-U-I, Generis, G-E-N-E-R-I-S. I think that's Latin. I didn't take Latin, though, so I'm probably screwing the whole thing up. It's number two of their Barrel Age series. And it comes in a 12-ounce bottle. It is 10.5% ABV. Avery calls it a complex ale aged and artfully blended from several types of oak barrels. So they made the sour beer, and they aged it in different types of oak barrels. Sui Generis, again, I'm probably screwing that up, displays a delightful lactic sourness complemented by hints of Brett, oak, and acid. Intricate yet bold. Sui Generis was crafted in the tradition of perennial taproom favorites Die Wolkenbergendigen, Du Phenabula, what the hell kind of name is that? And Voltron, which sounds like a character in Lord of the Rings. This brew was drawn from the most unique group of oak barrels. It's a blend of ales from 39% Cabernet Sauvignon barrels, 35% Chardonnay barrels, 13% Port barrels, and 13% Bourbon barrels. Huh, 39, 35, 13, 13. Hey, that's 100%. That is good. They didn't screw me up on that. You know what? I figured that out because I wasn't drinking. Well, let's have it. I got a thing here. I'm going to open it right in front of you. Oh, yeah. Wow. That was nice. Smell? Oop, smells sour. Now we pour the beer. I don't want to pour too much. Okay, let's get a look at this sucker. It's a nice ruby dark amber. It's got a nice, good and thick head. Let's smell. It smells like it's got some funk. A little sour. Can smell some grape. Definitely smell grapes in here. And it smells a lot like the Brabant did. It was, you know, kind of sour. Brettanomyces, lactobacillus, you name it. Taste. Oh, man, you know, that's good. That's a little sticky. But that is good. You know what? You know what this reminds me of? This reminds me of the beers that my good friend, Peter Huey, who was the brewmaster at Sacramento Brewing, who has now opened a brewery with our good friend Rick, Odonata. He makes some of the best sour beers I've ever had. You heard me talk about him earlier this year. We did the Capital Gain show, and I rant and raved about him. This is what that's like. Here's the deal. A lot of these breweries, and New Belgium has their own section or their own line of sour beers. They're horrible. Seriously, they're just over-the-top funkiness. It's like, you know, it's one thing. You hand me a nice beer, it's fine. Don't kick me in the balls with it. You know, it's really seriously. I mean, I don't need to have my whole face contorted. That bitter beer face. This doesn't do that. And Peter's beers don't do that. Peter knows how to make a sour beer. This is like that. It's great. I'm going to really drink this now. Hold on a second. If you told me this was 10%, I would tell you you were a liar. Very medium bodied. In fact, it's finishing very, very tight. Maybe this should age. I don't want it to age. I want to drink it. It's good. I bet if this aged, it wouldn't finish like that. But that finish is not killing it. It's great. It's really, it probably could use another year to become the complex beer that it should be. But as it is, it's tremendous. I'll tell you what, if you made funky beers like this all the time, I'd drink them more often. Now, can I sell it that way? Probably. That's the kind of beer this is. Fantastic. Rick, thank you so much, man. This is going to last me the whole show. I can tell you that right now. Pour a little more in there. So I took a nice big swig. Man, that was good stuff. All right. We got the beer, did the intro. Let's talk brass tacks. Tony Bourdain has a new book, Medium Raw. It's scheduled for release on June 8th of next year. That's going to be a long 6 months to wait for a book, but June 8th it is. I got to wonder, did he time the release of this book around the anniversary of the invasion of Normandy? Is that possible? You know, he's kind of like, he's a bit of World War II, Vietnam War kind of geek, and he's, you know, French, likes France. If he did, I think it's cool. I hope he did that. But June 8th, that's a weird month. Does it take that long? The cover's already done. Maybe it needs to be edited. Who knows? He's a great writer. I love what he writes. Grub Street now calls him the elder statesman of food. And they talked to him about his book, and he calls it a bloody Valentine to the world of food and the people who cook, which I guess is his sequel to Kitchen Confidential. Here's a quote from Grub Street. Bourdain says, "I guess I'm less interested in being cruel or malicious just for the sake of a laugh. I mean, Sandra Lee is pretty low-hanging fruit. On the other hand, one of the reasons I've been so unpleasant on the subject of Alice Waters is that I suspect she might be right about most things, in principle anyway. The disconnect between message and messenger seems to be what drives me batty." Sirius Eats said he did manage to write the most vicious, hateful, an angry single chapter of his life called Heroes and Villains. It's like riding a bike you'd never forget. Anyway, June 8th, 2010. You've got a long time to wait for that book.
How much longer am I going to do this? I don't know. I love it, you see. I love heating duck confit, saucisson de canard, confit gizzard, saucisson de Toulouse, poitrine and duck fat with those wonderful tarbay beans, spooning it into an earthenware crock, and sprinkling it with breadcrumbs. I love making those little mountains of chive mashed potatoes, wild mushrooms, riz de veau, a nice tall microgreen salad as garnish, drizzling a perfectly reduced sauce around the plate with my favorite spoon. I enjoy the look on the face of my boss when I do a pot au feu special, the look of sheer delight as he takes the massive bowl of braised hooves, shoulders, and tails in, the simple boiled turnips, potatoes, and carrots looking just right, just the way it should be. I love that look. As I loved the look on Pino's face when he gazed upon a perfect bowl of spaghetti alla catara. The same look I get when I approach a Scott Bryan dobe of beef, a plate of perfect oysters. It's a gaze of wonder, the same look you see on small children's faces when their fathers take them into deep water at the beach, and it's always a beautiful thing. For a moment, or a second, the pinched expressions of the cynical, world-weary, throat-cutting, miserable bastards we've all had to become disappears when we're confronted with something as simple as a plate of food. Would we remember what it was that moved us down this road in the first place?
Greg Kane from FineLobster.com and CrabPlace.com is joining us again today to spread some holiday cheer. Greg, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Phil. Glad to be back.
How are things in New England right now? You guys feeling the Christmas spirit yet?
Well, we're frantic at the moment. There's a lot of people looking for some great seafood gifts, and we're hot and heavy at the moment, so we're excited about Christmas this year.
Well, that's good, Greg. You know, when I had you on the show back in September, I'd asked you what the official beginning and end of lobster season was, and you said there was no real lobster season per se. But now that it's December, getting into January, we're basically gearing up for a really hard winter. I wanted to ask you, does it make it harder for the lobster fishermen to catch lobster, or are there even more of them filling the traps?
Well, Christmas is a busy season, and they get to fish as long as weather permits. So, we're still in the milder part of winter, and, right now is a good time for the lobster men to be able to sell the product. So, they go out and get it, and we've got plenty. Demand is tremendous this time of year, but, they're bringing them in, and we're finding homes for them.
Yeah, and anyone who watches Deadliest Catch on Discovery Channel sees how dangerous it is for Alaskan king crab fishermen out there. Are there the same dangers for lobster fishermen in Maine during colder, stormier weather, or is it more of a laid-back affair, Greg?
Well, I mean, it's not on the level of dangerous catch. Obviously, anytime you're on the water and winter conditions can certainly make it more treacherous than in the summertime. Dangerous catch, those pots are, a couple thousand pounds apiece for the king crab fishermen. And because of the short season, they're going 2 weeks at a crack. So, not quite as dramatic as that. But, like I said, those guys, they work hard for their catch. And there are times that, it gets a little sticky out on the water. But, much safer than the king crab industry.
Does the change in temperatures and weather conditions affect the food supply for the lobsters?
No, I don't think so. The lobster, they have a molting season as well where they shed, and that affects some of the meat quality. But coming into winter, it's similar with the crab. Once they've stopped shedding, they'll hold their meat inside. So, the wintertime's a good time for a nice quality lobster, and the stuff we're seeing now is of a premium quality.
Man, I could only imagine how busy you are. I wanted to touch on this one topic because we were talking about this earlier. Here in California, our government is on the verge of making fishing illegal off of certain areas of our coast due to overfishing. Are there any fears on your coast of the same thing happening, Greg?
More in the crab industry, not the lobster industry. It's been a tough year for lobster. Just with the recession and lobster's more of a premium category, so it's an area that gets hit hard in a downturn like this. So at the moment, I don't think anybody's worried about cutting the catch. They want to make sure there's homes for the product on a year-round basis. The crab industry has been in decline for a good while from a catch standpoint. So the thought is there may be too many harvesting, a supply that's dwindling, and pollution runoff has a part to play in that as well. But regulations are always being looked at, and you want to make sure you don't get to a point where it's critical and it's past the point of being recoverable. But right now for the lobster industry, it's pretty stable, I think it will be stable for some years to come.
Well, thanks, Greg. I only bring it up because we're seeing so many things with endangerment, with bluefin tuna, things like that. So it's good to know that the lobster industry will be here for years to come. Now, I wanted to talk about this because it's Christmas and we're celebrating the last show of the year here. What is a traditional New England Christmas like?
Well, it's cold. The feast will change. It's different in all parts of the country. And from a New England perspective, there's a lot of seafood being consumed. Lobster is definitely on the menu. You have your lobster rolls and definitely lobster tail, and you may see some lobster bisque on the table from a menu perspective. And you almost guaranteed a Christmas snow, so, you get the white Christmas that everybody dreams of. It's a beautiful part of the country, and Christmas is special there. It's a great time of year.
All around the country, whether you're here in the Midwest or whatever, people celebrate Christmas pretty much the same way. It's either a ham, a turkey, or a prime rib roast or something. Doing a seafood feast sounds far better.
Well, and that's one of the reasons we're so busy at Christmas. We ship nationwide, and we hit all 50 states every year, so whether you're trying something different or you just happen to be a transplanted, person from New England or from the East Coast or whatever, and you just feel like you can't get your seafood, there's plenty of people out there that really yearn for, something different at Christmas or maybe a tradition that they've had trouble experiencing since the move. And we're thrilled to fill that gap for people. It's a great time of year to serve up some seafood.
Greg, when I was growing up, we always had fish on Christmas Eve, and I grew up in a Sicilian house, and I never knew why that was until much later in life. As it turns out, no meat is eaten on Christmas Eve in celebration of the birth of Jesus. I didn't know if this was a Catholic thing or what, since, we weren't Catholic, but it was a tradition, an Italian tradition. Does this lobster feast have anything to do with that?
You're right. I think it is more of a Catholic tradition, Catholic myself, but it's usually geared towards fish on Friday. It's just really no meat what it's supposed to do. And lobster, I don't think there's any reason that wouldn't be a suitable substitution, but you're catching a product that's such a premium product in your backyard and you get to enjoy it. It just, you know, I think for more that reason than any, I mean, that's where you see New England just knows how to throw a lobster bake. You know, Maryland knows how to throw a crab feast. And you know, they're the best in the world at it. So, you know, that tends to be their staple dinner for the great times of the year, such as a Christmas Eve dinner feast.
I'll tell you what, if you don't know what to get your boss or a colleague or a friend for Christmas and you really want to surprise them, why not buy them a lobster from finelobster.com? Everybody chips in $5, $10. You know, you don't want to buy your boss something lame like a tie or a singing fish on a wall plaque or a round of golf that he's not going to remember. Get him a live lobster. Have it delivered to his house or maybe some frozen lobster tails or a complete dinner package. Do you see a lot of people buying lobster and crabs as gifts around Christmas, Greg?
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, I mean, that's primarily. We do have the dinner crowd looking for themselves, but they're just a ton of gift givers. And they do. They make such a great gift. If you don't, you know, if you don't know what to get someone, I mean, you take pride in the region that you're in, and it just makes a creative way of you know, being proud of where you're from and getting somebody a tremendous gift on the other side. And, yeah, a live lobster to your doorstep, you certainly remember that one for years to come. So it makes a tremendous gift opportunity.
Now, you also have gift cards, too. Is that correct?
That's right. Yep, we have gift cards that they can use at any time. We have lobster tails that, you know, don't have the live lobster, when it shows up, you've got to prepare it in the next day or two. Lobster tails you can keep in the freezer for up to 6 months, and they can bring out and use as needed. We've got a special actually that we launched today for the last 10 days or so of Christmas, that orders over $100. Get the free 2-day shipping. We've been running that all December, but then orders over 125 also will include two 6 to 7 ounce lobster tails for free.
Oh man, that is great!
Don't get much more value than that, you know. So over 125, you get the free 2-day shipping plus 2 6 to 7 ounce tails on top of it. It's a terrific value. Makes a great last minute gift for somebody that's just hard to buy for. For the next 10 days, we're giving away 6 to 7 ounce lobster tails. You get two. On any order over $125, you just enter in the coupon code of free lobster, F-R-E-E lobster, in the coupon code field at finelobster.com when you check out. It'll dump in your cart, and you'll get some free lobster tails, you know, on your doorstep along with your regular order.
Yeah, now who is going to say no to some free lobster?
You'd have to be crazy.
Listen, I got a lot of crazy people listening to this show, Greg. Yeah, you've got 1 week left to shop for Christmas. It's a really thoughtful gift. Nobody is going to say no to a lobster feast. Now, Greg, what is the last day that people can order from finelobster.com to ensure that their lobsters and crabs get there by Christmas?
There's actually delivery on Christmas Eve. You know, you can overnight out on the 23rd for Christmas Eve. The free 2-day that I referenced, you know, would need to be in 2 p.m. Eastern on the 22nd, and there's still guaranteed delivery for the 24th. The website at finelobster.com and crabplace.com both will give you a calendar during checkout, so you can pick the exact date. You don't have to worry about when it's going to show up. Are they going to be there? You know, are they going to be traveling? You get to select exactly what day, and we queue the order accordingly.
That's great. Now, listen, that lobster bisque that you guys sell on your website, now, I imagine that's a big seller right about now because it's a really hearty, healthy, cold-weather soup. Do you guys sell a lot of that in the winter?
Yeah, lobster bisque is a big mover. You know, between that and the tails, we sell lobster meat as well and the live lobster. Those are our four main products, you know, at the holidays. And, you know, all of them are great. But the lobster bisque, they come in a 64-ounce pack. You know, you just, all you need to do is simmer it to, you know, to get it warm. It's, you know, it's a terrific product. It's got a great taste to it, little minced pieces of lobster throughout it. It's a fantastic soup. And, yes, it moves well at the holidays.
He's Greg Kane from finelobster.com and crabplace.com. You've got 1 week left, so give the gift of food this holiday season without ever having to leave the house. Hey, Greg, thanks again for being on the show with us today, for helping us close out the year in style.
You're most welcome, Phil. Thank you.
Happy holidays, man.
Same to you.
Remember sitting like Tiny Tim at the dinner table with your perfect, happy, Walton-style family? Dad passing out the presents, and of course, you got just what you wanted. The excitement of sleigh rides, parades, wholesome holiday cheer. Nah, me neither. How about finding out that the fat guy in the red suit who was so friendly at the department store had outstanding warrants in 6 states?
Ho, ho, ho.
That grandpa was only friendly because he was a drunk, and that the secret fort you used to play with in the backyard was your cousin Cletus's meth lab.
You heard me talking to Greg about lobster bisque, and there's a reason I brought it up, because it is a great soup for the holidays. It's just a great soup for the winter. It's an opulent soup. It's a gourmet hug, really. You know, I like chicken soup. I like pork and beans. I like every kind of soup. I like Italian wedding soup. I like albondigas, tortilla soup. But lobster bisque, any bisque, whether it be shrimp or lobster, whatever you made it with, even oysters, I don't care, clam chowder. But lobster bisque is it's got depth. It's like a fish creamy soup with balls. And there's so many different ways you can make this soup. There's so many different recipes. I went through all my cookbooks. I've got 5 different recipes for bisque, and they're all different. And guess whose I go back to every time? Although I have changed it quite a bit. Bourdain, of course, Layal cookbook. I pimped the shit out of that book, but there's a reason for it. It's an easy recipe. You can go really hard. And a lot of these recipes call for you making your own fish stock. You want to make your own fish stock? Cats love it. Anyway, I'm going to give you his recipe because I know you're going to want to buy this book if I keep pimping the shit out of it. And as I said, I did change a few things. He's a little crazy. Some of the stuff he does is nuts. And I've played with this recipe quite a bit. And I'll tell you something. Ask Joe, Afaf, David, Bob from the Bob Show. They tasted it and they liked it. I think Bob tasted it. Maybe he didn't. Anyway, here's what you need to make this bisque. And believe me, if you don't want to make the bisque, fine. I would urge you to get the bisque from finelobster.com. Or if you want to send a gourmet hug to a family member or somebody, anybody, order that soup. Because I'm telling you, it is the best soup for the winter. But if you'd like to make it, here's what you're going to need. 6 pounds of lobster to start. And what I mean 6 pounds of lobster, that could be 3 2-pound lobsters or 2 3-pound lobsters, whatever. And as a side note, you know, whole lobsters are expensive. And you don't want to buy live lobster to make soup. You buy dead lobster. You buy a deceased lobster, or a stiff, as they call it. And basically what you do is you go to your fishmonger and say, you have any stiffs? He'll know what you mean. Say, I'm looking for some dead lobster. I want to make soup. They probably have them in the freezer. Or maybe they don't have them. Believe me, if you come back next week, they'll have some. But get some lobster. If you don't want to buy a whole lobster, buy some claws, buy some tails, buy something with some meat in it and some shells on it. 6 pounds worth. 2 onions, finely chopped. Listen, everything I'm going to mention that's a vegetable, finely chopped. The reason is this. You're not going to blend this soup, so it is what it is. If you can get it really finely chopped, great. It's because none of it's really going to end up in the soup unless it manages to pass through the strainer, but a lot of it is not. Anyway, 2 onions, finely chopped. 4 garlic cloves, sliced, not chopped. 2 leeks, only the white parts, finely chopped. 2 celery stalks, finely chopped. 1 tablespoon of tomato paste, 1/4 cup of cognac, 6 cups of water, 1 bouquet garni. If you don't know what bouquet garni is, I'm going to explain that to you. Very French, and you'll need to know what it is anyway. Salt and pepper, 2 cups of heavy cream, the juice of 1/2 lemon, and 2 tablespoons of chopped fresh chives, and that's for garnish. To make the soup, the first thing you want to do is cut the lobster into pieces. And Bourdain says there are several points on a lobster's body where cuts can be made, and he's right. Here's the thing. You don't want to screw up your knife, okay? So the best thing to do is to start with the tail. You know, the tail connects to the body, and you can just kind of like weave that in with the bottom part of your knife and chop it just on a downward motion, chop the tail, disconnect the tail from the body. And while you're at it, kind of drain the top of that head cavity because there's some goop in there you're probably not going to want. So get in there, drain that out. And then where the claws, wherever there basically is a joint, that's where you basically want to cut. And try to do all your cuts with the base part of your knife, the thickest bottom part of your knife, because that's basically where you're going to get the most force and you can be able to slice the stuff. And make sure, you know, you sharpen that knife before you go, and it won't be a problem for you. Once you've done that, heat some oil, about 3 tablespoons of oil in a large pot. And when it gets nice and hot, you want to add the chunks of lobster that are in the shell. Cook it over high heat for 5 to 6 minutes until the shells are bright and red all over. Now, you want to continue to stir this, okay? You don't want to scorch it. You don't want the stuff to burn. You just want to get it nice and hot. Once it turns red, add all the vegetables, and add the garlic too, and then cook that until soft and translucent. Keep stirring. Don't burn anything, okay? Stir in the tomato paste and mix that really well. Let that cook for about 2 minutes, okay? Remove the pot from the heat, and then take that quarter cup of cognac and pour it in. Make sure you take that pan off the heat before you do this, okay? Otherwise, you're going to blow your face up. You really don't want to burn stuff. It's going to be a nice show. A nice little cloud of good smell and stuff is going to come at your face. It's great. With the spoon, you want to scrape the bottom of the pot. You're going to deglaze it now, all right? There's going to be some brown stuff on the bottom of the pan. You want to scrape that up with the cognac. Bring it back to the fire. Add the water and the bouquet garni, and then season it with salt and pepper. Bring it to a boil, reduce the heat, and simmer it. Let the soup simmer over the low heat for about 45 minutes. Okay, let me explain what bouquet garni is. It's used for flavoring, usually in stews and sauces and soups. It's kind of like a French flavoring. And if you know what bouquet garni is and you're able to use it effectively, it'll come in very handy because it's in a lot of dishes. You tie it in a cheesecloth. Basically what it is one flat piece of parsley, two sprigs of thyme, and one bay leaf. You tie that together, put it in some cheesecloth, and drop it in. The reason why you put it in cheesecloth is after you're done, you can just easily just pick it out because you don't want, you know, stringy stuff in your food. And that's basically what bouquet garni is. And it's the flavoring of French food. So after that's done, about 45 minutes, you've been simmering this. You want to take a slotted spoon or some tongs, remove the lobster pieces from the soup, and set them aside, allow them to cool. This is where I differ from Bourdain. What Bourdain wants you to do at this point is put this stuff, all of it, with the shells and everything, in a blender and blend it and then put it back in the soup. I tried this once. It sucked. In fact, I blew up my blender doing it. And I've done it without, and it tastes great. I don't know what Bourdain's thinking. Maybe his soup tastes different than mine, but mine tastes fine. And I'm giving you my recipe. Listen, if you want Bourdain's recipe, go buy the damn book, all right? It's Philly's world over here. Anyway, when this stuff cools, carefully crack the shells, get the meat out of there. The tail is the best meat anyway. Get the tail for sure. What you want to do is this. You want to make sure that the shells that you're, you know, taking the meat out of stay as intact as possible. Any small pieces, throw them away. The bigger pieces, the pieces that are manageable, those are the ones you want to keep. The bottom line is this. You're going to take those shells, they're going to go back in your soup. And then you're going to cook it longer, then you're going to strain it. If you get little tiny pieces of shell in there that might make it back in the soup, that's bad news. You don't want that. So basically what you want to do is take the claws, crack them, take the tails, split them, take the meat out, and reserve the meat, take the shells, put it back in the soup. Stir in the cream, okay, you've got the 2 cups of cream, bring the mixture back to a boil, reduce it to a simmer, and cook it for another 30 minutes. After 30 minutes, turn off the heat, strain the soup into a medium pot, really strain it. I mean, if you need to strain it twice, if you've got a chinois, they're about $150 or more, strain it really well. You want to make sure there's nothing in this soup. If some vegetables kind of fall through, that's okay. It's okay to have those in, but this is really kind of a liquid soup. But the flavor of the meat, the shells, everything is in there. After you're done, you can season it with a little salt and pepper, taste it, season it, and it's ready to serve. Scoop it into bowls, and then take some of that meat that you've reserved, chop it up, chunk it up, serve it right in the middle, and garnish it with the chives. If you don't have chives, you can use parsley. You don't even have to garnish it if you don't want. And that's it. Now, my friend Don makes it, and he likes to put in a splash of Pernod, which is that anisette-flavored French liqueur. And that tastes really good. So you can do that, Pernod, or if you want to put in some tarragon, you can kind of get that anise flavor if you like it. I prefer not to do that. I just kind of serve a straight soup. Either way, that's my version of Tony's lobster bisque. It is delicious. And if you want to see Tony's real recipe, you can buy the Leal cookbook from Amazon.com. I think it's about $15. Get it while it's hot.
One of my things, when I go to a restaurant, I would never order something, I rarely would order something that was just grilled with a little sauce on it. Because quite honestly, I can make it at home. I would probably buy a better product and it will take me less time. Mm-hmm. And I don't have to meet a waiter.
Right.
So when I go to a restaurant, I want to go to get something that takes more time than I'm willing to commit for the meal that day, or something that I appreciate the amount of time and effort that was spent in making it delicious. Tripe isn't just something you put on the grill and take off and serve up. It takes a while, it takes technique, it takes a brain, and that's why organ meats, I'm sure, appeal to you as well, in addition to the tradition of the really great European cultural tables.
I tend to like, particularly when they emanated from poor people, from the need to transform. I'm interested in the process of transforming something tough or not particularly lovely into something kind of magical. I showed up at David Chang's at Momofuku Sam the first time, and you know, that tripe dish with the frisée salad on top. Yeah. I just thought, this is the most goddamn amazing thing.
Right.
It just so clever. And you know, so that was very gratifying to see somebody take something, you know, really old school, or two really old school things, and put them together in a creative way. I mean, that's where the fun is. Otherwise, it's...
Well, that's also where you get much more depth of flavor.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot more game going on than just a tenderloin or a pork chop in something that's actually worked for a living. Like the intestine or the brain.
Eat Me Daily had a contest last month where you could win the Top Chef Quick Fire Challenge cookbook. I entered it, and I won. I never won anything, man. So that was a big deal for me. Anyway, it came recently, and you don't want to know something? It's a really good book. It's pretty awesome. I mean, you've seen this thing at Target or something, but this is different. It's new. It just got released in September. It's got an orange cover with... silver foil binder, and it's padded, so it's real nice, and it's soft like Padma, who introduces the book, and she's all right. It's so awesome that if it comes out updated with recipes from season 6 next year, I'm just going to buy the damn thing, because it's that good, really. The photography is great. It's packed with information. If you're a Top Chef fan, even if you don't cook the recipes, just a great book to have, just to kind of review the past seasons. Everybody is in there with complete bios from each season, and a lot of the detail in the recipes is really exciting. Thing is, I have to wonder, how the hell do they remember what they put into those dishes? Because you've seen the show, right? They've got like 30 minutes to construct a dish. How do you know what you did? How do you know how you did it and how much of what you used? It's kind of mind-boggling to me. Then again, I'm not a professional chef, so I don't know. Maybe it's easy for them. But they've got some actual challenges that you can participate in, like name the ingredient, test your foodie IQ, another one called Who Cooked It, where they name the dish and the season, then you have to guess who cooked the dish, The Last Supper, which is a game that we've played here on the show most of the year, how to throw your own home quickfire party, cocktail recipes from all the Top Chef chef-testants, and one of the coolest things, a mise en place tips and tricks section. So you know how to dice an onion really quick, how to trim an artichoke at lightning speed, shuck oysters without stabbing yourself, and break down a chicken like hung. All right, maybe you won't be able to do that just like him, but you'll be able to do it pretty damn quick. Really nice tips. Just really good. A good book for foodies. Top Chef Quick Fire Challenge Cookbook. You can get it on Amazon.com. It might be a nice last-minute gift idea for the foodie in your life. A really good book. Thanks again to Bravo for sending this book to me and to Eat Me Daily for throwing the contest. I love Eat Me Daily. It's in my reader every day. I read it all the time. I get a lot of really good show ideas from Eat Me Daily as well. So thanks for that. Listen, I want to end the show in true style by looking back at a few really cool moments that happened on the show in 2009. There were a lot of them, but you know, I can't include them all, but these are kind of some of my favorites and some of yours too. And before I play it though, I want to thank you guys for listening this year. I cannot tell you how great it's been to produce this show every time, knowing that once it's done and uploaded, someone's going to listen. I started this thing off, I had maybe 3 people listening, including me and my wife. And my stats and my hits on the site now are so great that I could never have imagined that I'd see this kind of traffic. I looked at stat reports recently, and it goes all the way back to when I started, and it was almost sad how few downloads I had. And I looked at it now, and it's amazing. It really is. So I want to thank you all for your support. Seriously, if I started naming names, I'd be here all damn day. We did one of these on Dude Night, the first season of Dude Night, the end of the year. We did one. It took like 5 to 6 minutes. This probably would take me half an hour. I have so many people I could thank. I don't want to loop you all in. Just know that every one of you, the guys, everyone who emails me, everyone who comments on the blog, all my friends, everybody, I just want to say thanks.
You know who you are, and my show would not be running if you guys weren't listening. Thanks to Rick for the sui generis. I'm starting to feel every ABV of that 10% right about now, and I thank you. Thanks to Greg Kane for checking in. Don't forget, order over $100 and get free two-day shipping. Orders $125 or more will receive two free lobster tails. Go to finelobster.com, enter your coupon code FREELOBSTER when you check out, and have yourself a feast courtesy of finelobster.com. Music in this episode from Nickelback. If you like the song, you can download it in the iTunes store. Enjoy the clips. Have a Merry Christmas and a happy and safe new year. I'll see you guys in 2010. I'm going to bring it better and stronger than I have this year. Until next year, my name is Phil. This has been My Life as a Foodie. Happy New Year, everybody. And according to this proposed act, even if you don't sell directly to consumers, they're still going to show you up to your farm whenever they want, put a flashlight up your ass, and check you out and tell you what to do. Now listen, I don't say this all that often. I try not to curse on the show, but what the f***? Dude, what was that? What'd you bleep me for? You don't have to bleep me, dude. I'm on a podcast. It's a podcast. I can say that word. Seriously, you're killing me over here. Anyway, at what point are we going to stop being governed? I mean, you want to talk about food safety. You're looking at the wrong group of people. And take a look up the FDA's ass. They're not inspecting 10% of the food coming into our country from other sources. And that's the food that's getting people sick. It's rotten disease laced with poop. Thank you, Pantscast.
I've been to a bar in Spain and had breakfast. And the guy, you know, you ask, you know, what you're having, like the little cheese toasties for breakfast. The guy's pulling them out. You know, he touches the money. He grabs the food. He puts it in the grill. He makes a breakfast for you. They don't. It's not like it's a big thing. It's not a problem. I mean, we just everything's overblown over here so bad to the point where we try to just take every germ, make everything right. You know, go for it. So what if you get a little sick?
So you can't deny that shit in food makes you sick.
It's part of it, yeah, but it's part of life. It's just the way it is. I mean, if you try to defend yourself against everything, you're not going to live.
So you think it's the fact that we're weak?
Yeah, we're a bunch of fucking pussies. How's that? You know what?
I'm a horror movie whore, all right? So it really makes me laugh. Every time he comes on, this is what I hear. I hear this dude. He, no matter what he says.
Little bit of the sweet potatoes.
You know, I he sounds like this dude.
They leave their coffins at night.
Come on, man. He sounds just like that dude. Love that.
Having pipes jammed down your throat and food pumped directly into your stomach repeatedly so that you felt as if you might explode.
Oh, dude, listen. I felt that the other night at Bazaar. Like they were sticking a pipe down my throat and feeding me until I might explode. But I'll tell you what, I'd have died happy, just like the geese.
This is what young ducks and geese endure every day, solely to satisfy the demand for foie gras.
Hey, I'll tell you something. I may have grown up with foie gras liver. You know how much pasta I was forced to eat as a kid? I mean, if you're a kid in an Italian home for dinner, you're hosed. I mean, I hope you haven't eaten all day, because the mountain of pasta that they're going to pile in front of you and force feed you with would choke a moose. And I wonder what Roger Moore's wife did to him to make him do this. I mean, look at this. This is James Bond. The guy used to ski downhill, shooting machine guns, drinking martinis, sleeping with European broads three at a time. Now he's defending ducks and geese for a bunch of tofu-eating liberals? Okay. Yeah, you're not pussy-whipped.
If you could have one classic horror movie figure to your house for dinner, who would it be?
Mr. Frankenstein.
I just had him for dinner at the beginning of the show.
Did you?
Yeah, and listen, let me tell you, it was no picnic.
No, he is such a dove. Have you ever played, like, Parcheesi with him? Get the board games out. He is so good at Twister.
So, I'm going to dry cure the sausage, but when it's done, if I haven't screwed the whole thing up, it should be botulism-free. But because I don't want to take the risk myself, I thought maybe I could send some to you and you can try it. You know, be my guinea pig. That way, if it kills you, I know I shouldn't eat it, and you'll come back to life anyway. How does that sound? You up for that?
Oh, yes. So I do food testing. I mean, I dive for a living, so anytime anyone wants to test some crap out on me, like, they just sent me this thing called swine flu vaccination, and I just recently injected it. I feel fine. Send me all of your pork products. I will test them first.
But no, I think it was my infatuation, not only with Julia Child, but the Galloping Gourmet, that turned my mother off to the idea. Graham Kerr was his name. That dude used to drink a whole bottle of wine. He'd get hammered on his show. He would just get blitzed. And she said, you know, you're a young boy, you should be out playing sports. Which I did, by the way. But gourmet, that was out of the question. And galloping was out of the question. Now, in the town where I was growing up, you put galloping and gourmet together, and that's an express train to an ass-kicking. It was a tough town where I grew up. Neighborhood beatings were handed out daily. I got those, too. So, an 8-year-old galloping gourmet for a son probably would have made my mother's already tough life a little bit tougher. I could not tell you that this wasn't chicken. If I ate it blindly, I couldn't tell you I wasn't eating chicken. I don't know why people bother eating alligator, raising them and eating them, when we have so many chickens walking around. We'd eat those. What kind of work goes into raising and killing an alligator? And it's dangerous. I mean, something that would love to eat you, to eat your lower torso and play with your dead corpse like a rag doll. Just eat a freaking chicken. It's less work, tastes great. 2 days before Christmas, I discover this blog written by this gal, Joe. It's called My Last Bite, mylastbite.com. Anyway, she has this post on molecular gastronomy. Anyway, she writes how it's her new addiction after having taken a class on molecular gastronomy in November at Sur La Table here in L.A. Why didn't I know about this? I want to do this. A chemistry set in my kitchen? I mean, that's better than power tools. In any event, I love her blog, because after that, I just started reading it. I'm like, man, I really like how she writes. I mean, it's my kind of foodie journalism and photography. And she makes it look simple. And if you can make it look simple, and that takes talent, because I know it's not simple. None of this is simple. So I comment on her blog, and she's like my favorite person in the world right now. And I'm going to do this. So she emails me. She's excited for me. She says she's going to send me a video from Jose Andres making these spheres. And if I'd like to see it, she can make a DVD for me. Just unreal. I'm a total stranger. She's excited that I'm getting into this. Just a real sweet person. So it really takes me by surprise when people show that kind of kindness. I mean, I've met some really incredibly kind and giving people on the internet, especially through podcasting. But she takes a cake.